All right, everybody, can I have your attention? We've got a special guest today at the Spotty Dog. It's not his first time. Tony Fletcher's here to read for us from his fantastic new memoir, Boy About Town. Has anybody heard Tony's radio show on WGXC? Every fourth Tuesday of the month?
Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Not that there's anything wrong with Tuesdays.
Fourth Wednesday of the month, he plays all kinds of...
Meaning, it's not personal.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
They're going. All right. He plays great music from England, all over of the... it's punk.
Did I play it on the radio show? I play all kinds of stuff.
You play all kinds.
I was playing some mambo the other day, so...
Okay.
Yeah, all different kinds.
But we'll let you speak for yourself now, everybody. Tony Fletcher.
Thank you. And am I positioned okay for these microphones?
For those...
This will probably help me out. I love this place. It's one of my favourite places, and I'm sure that many people love to come here just for drink. Who's here for the reading? And is that somebody you just stumbled upon the reading? Yeah, you're here for the reading. Great. I know I have an audience. Good. I was wondering if you were just politely turning around, because it's like, oh my gosh, somebody's going to talk. All right, I appreciate that. This is actually the third event I've done here. This is truly one of my favourite places. And it's always nice to be here. And I figure this is Sunday afternoon. You can have a beer. You can hear me talk a little bit. I was tempted to read the same sections of this as I've been reading elsewhere. But given that we're recording it, it's going to go out. And one of the other ones was recorded. I'm going to just chance it and do a couple of different sections. And I'm almost doing this on the fly. So this memoir, give you the very quick background. I have a little bit of a track record now as a biographer, music biographer, journalist. Been doing this for a long time. I started out doing a fanzine at school back in the punk days in London, and I always kind of felt there was an interesting enough story there that if I could tell it right, I could balance my unusual story of doing a fanzine as a teenager and meeting all these rock stars and non-rock stars with a sort of everyman or every boy story, and that was my intent with this book. So the book is called Boy About Town. It really starts in 1972 when I find myself at a record store. I don't know. Actually, you can. Do you mind setting him up with that? He's got his headphones. Noel's going to make music on GarageBand while I'm reading, so maybe he can play the results when I'm done. The book starts in 1972 when I sort of find myself at a record store for the first time with given the opportunity to buy a record. I buy a David Cassidy single because my big brother tells me to. And it follows on, and it ends in the summer of 1980. I'm not going to really get close to that part. But it ends in the summer of 1980 when I'm 16, where a whole bunch of things that are in the book kind of come to a head. And so I'm going to read maybe three or four sections to keep this brief. The chapters are pretty brief. Hi, come in and make yourself at home, and if you want to just sit off in the corner and chat amongst yourselves, that's fine. And browse your books. I'm just like, they don't know what I'm doing here, I'm just talking. They're going to get rid of me soon enough. I'm going to read three or four sections and see how they relate, and maybe just follow the start of getting into my music life changing and starting the fanzine. And the book is a top 50 countdown. So the first chapter is number 50, the last chapter is number 1. This one is number 42. It's called Something Better Change. And of course, every chapter is a song title, if I didn't say that already. John Matthews was one of the only other kids in my year who cared about rock. He bought the 3 weekly music papers, rotating Melody Maker with Sounds and New Musical Express. He bought albums. When I was going to see Queen, and that was the first show I ever went to, was to go see Queen, which made up a little bit for David Cassidy to be my first single. When I was going to see Queen, he offered to make me a tape of their album, Sheer Heart Attack, and he was good to his word. He put the record on his stereo, placed a portable cassette player on his desk, and hit the record button. Occasionally, his parents walked into his room and talked over it. And at one point, I could hear him singing along. But that was okay. It made it more like a bootleg, like my own personalized copy. But why was he so excited this Thursday morning? I hadn't even made it across the playground before he cornered me. Did you see it last night? Did you see it? Did I see what? It had to be something to do with music. I mean, that was the one thing we had in common. Yet Top of the Pops hadn't been on last night. Nor had the Old Grey Whistle Test, the one show that had hard rock bands performed live in the studio, though it was on too late at night for most of us. I pushed for more information. On ITV, the Today Show, this group swore at Bill Grundy. The Sex Pistols, they're called. It was brilliant. It's all over the Mirror today. You must have seen that. But I hadn't. We didn't read the Daily Mirror at our house. I had tried buying the Sun for a while at the Caravan. Caravan's like having a mobile home. It's kind of a British thing on top of a cliff. Very nice it was. The football coverage was easier to read in the Sun, and it had more pictures. But my mother put a stop to that. She didn't want the lady at the village post office to get the wrong impression about us. And we didn't watch ITV either. We got our early evening news from the BBC. If the TV stayed on beyond that, it was for Nationwide, not the Today Show. I'd never even heard of Bill Grundy. By lunchtime, my family's middle-class habits had put me thoroughly in the minority. It seemed like half the school had spent their tea time watching this band called the Sex Pistols, with a singer named Johnny Rotten, of all things, saying the word fuck several times on live television. And John was right again. The Daily Mirror had plastered the incident all over the front cover under the headline, "The Filth and the Fury." To prove how outraged it was, the paper reprinted the entire interview, asterisk out swear word for asterisk out swear word. I was gutted. Events like this didn't happen in Britain. Sure, there were outrageous chants on the football terraces, and Monty Python used rude words on their albums, and Nicky Horn, when he had DJed at the Who concert at Charlton Football Ground, had said the word starfucker over the PA. But nobody ever said fuck on live TV. Not in Britain. At least not until now. And I had missed it. For the next few weeks leading up to Christmas, punk rock was rarely off the front pages of the tabloids. The Sex Pistols embarked on a tour to promote their single Anarchy in the UK on EMI, Britain's oldest and most prestigious record label. And yet they were banned from playing almost every show. The local councillors and clergy clearly convinced that if allowed to get on the stage, the band would... Well, nobody was sure what they would do, given that they didn't seem to be given the chance. Puke over everybody, as was rumoured. Spit on the audience. Smash up their instruments. Swear at people like they had on TV. Whatever it was, we, the British youth, evidently needed protecting from it. It wasn't just the political and religious establishment that was outraged and opposed. There was talk that other acts on EMI, people like Paul McCartney and Pink Floyd, didn't want to share a record label with the Sex Pistols. Sure enough, early in the new year, EMI dropped the Sex Pistols, and the group disappeared with it. Punk rock, though, did not. More and more bands started getting mentioned in the music papers. More singles were released. Albums, even. It appeared to be something of a movement. I wasn't yet 13. My concert experience had been confined to arenas, football grounds, and the Hammersmith Odeon. I couldn't begin to understand how entirely new forms of music emerged. But I'd had a vague sense that something was going on, even before this whole business with the Sex Pistols. Back in March, I'd been to my friend Jeffrey's 15th birthday party. I didn't stay long. The crowd was different than I'd expected. There were some serious long hairs in attendance, looking for trouble, and my mum had dressed me in my best clothes and even sent me off with a neatly wrapped present, so I felt totally out of place. And so was the music. Before I left, before the party descended into something of a riot and the neighbours called the police, I ought to ask Jeffries about the LP that everyone was singing along with. "Dr. Feelgood," he said. "Ace, isn't it?" He said it in a way like he thought I knew about them already, but I didn't. And I wasn't sure I liked it either. There was something primitive about this band, something old-fashioned, like it was a throwback to 1950s rock and roll, and it caught me off guard. I figured my friends were into more complex music than that. And then, when the new football season had started, I found some of the Dulwich crew, Piers especially, raving about an American band called the Ramones, who they'd seen play in England over the summer. Apparently they had a song that went, "Beat on the Brat with a Baseball Bat." I figured them for a joke at first, a novelty. Now I understood that they were a punk band too. This music had somehow crossed the Atlantic before I'd even realised it existed. Other than John Matthews, the only other kid in our year who had any real interest in rock music was Lawrence Weaver, whose dad worked for a firm of concert bouncers and got free records and tickets as a result. Lawrence was seriously into hard rock. His taste began with The Who and worked from there out towards Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple. And he started and ended any conversation about punk rock with the insistence that because the bands didn't care about playing their instruments properly, we shouldn't care about the bands. As a classically trained musician who was still taking regular cello lessons, I couldn't fault his logic. And that's why, come the spring of 1977, I was thrilled to see Pink Floyd play live at Wembley Empire Pool. I'd worked far too hard at developing good taste in rock music to let it go simply because of a couple of front covers about punk rock in the Daily Mirror. Pink Floyd were, I knew, the opposite end of rock music from The Who, which was my favourite group, but the more albums we added to the household collection, Umma Gummer and Metal had recently helped fill in some of the early gaps, the more I came to admire them. I mean, their musicianship didn't seem to be tied into fashion, it was beyond that. And yet they had somehow changed constantly over the years, from their first psychedelic album in 1967 to this new one, Animals, 10 years later. Animals had a picture of Battersea Power Station on the front cover, the same South London landmark that had featured prominently on the Quadrophenia sleeve, and that was neat. I liked too that the actual song Pigs, that's the 11-minute version in the middle of the album, as opposed to Pigs Part 1, which opened the record, and Part 2, which closed it, took a poke at Mary Whitehouse, the self-appointed guardian of public morals, who'd always had it in for Alice Cooper, and who had given her name, though not her permission, to a truly pornographic magazine I occasionally found under my brother's bed. So Pink Floyd were finally getting political. Right on. I went to Wembley on my own. Of course, I'd gone to every concert so far on my own. The Empire Pool was much like Olympia in terms of size and layout, and my seat was up and way back and far off to the side. When Pink Floyd took to the stage without a support act, they played the whole of the Animals album. Then they took a break, and when they came back, they played the whole of Wish You Were Here. For encores, they played two songs off The Dark Side of the Moon. None of the four members spoke to the audience throughout. None of them even moved, as far as I could tell from my distant seat. I could have stayed at home and played the albums on my stereo for all that there was anything personal about it. But then I wouldn't have seen the giant inflatable pig float across the hall. And after all, wasn't that half the fun of attending? I stood a little bit taller the next day at school, and I figured I would do so my next time out on the terraces too. After all, I wasn't yet 13, and I'd seen both The Who and Pink Floyd. I had serious rock credentials. And yet all of a sudden, it wasn't totally evident that they were the right ones. I mean, the Who part of it was okay. The Sex Pistols, so I read somewhere, covered Substitute and were on record as saying that the Who had been the punks of their day. But then one of the Sex Pistols has also been photographed wearing a t-shirt that read, "I hate Pink Floyd." Now this seemed childish to me, like he was jealous of their success and their skill. But apparently the Sex Pistols weren't the only ones. I started hearing how bands like Pink Floyd, with their 11-minute songs, their refusal to release singles, and their lack of communication or movement in concert, concerts that only took place in arenas or, as The Who were being criticised for now, football grounds, represented everything that had gone wrong with rock music. They were boring old farts. On Capital Radio, on Your Mother Wouldn't Like It, Nicky Horn had begun peppering the likes of Pink Floyd and The Who with more and more of what he carefully called New Wave, a term used to distinguish the idea of good new music from the less favourable aspects of punk rock. And I figured that it was my musical duty to see what I could get out of it. I didn't get to hear the Sex Pistols. Anarchy in the UK had been banned from the airwaves immediately after the Bill Grundy incident. And once the group were dropped from EMI, quickly became a rarity. Even if anyone I knew had a copy, they weren't looking to loan it. Of the other major bands connected to the New Wave, it seemed okay to like the Stranglers because they were proper musicians who paid their dues. Their vocals were rough, but the keyboard player evidently had some talent. It was all right, too, to like Eddie and the Hot Rods, who were connected to Dr. Feelgood by the fact that both came from Southend and were part of some pub rock back-to-basics movement that I might have known more about if I'd ever gotten into a pub. I wasn't so sure about The Clash. They seemed to be the notorious punk group after the Sex Pistols, but there was something genuinely scary about them. They looked like thugs, and they sounded like terrorists. There was also a group called The Damned, who were something of a cartoon band that no one took seriously. Least of all, so it seemed, themselves. That left only one other new wave band with an album out. They sounded discordant, unruly, dishevelled, and as much as anything, ugly. When I heard them on Nicky Horn, I had to turn the radio down. I disliked them so much. They were the boil on the abscess of punk rock, as far as I could make out, and I vowed to steer clear of them. They were called The Jam. So that's that chapter. And as you can probably guess, if you kind of take a look at the front of the book, that was about to change that perception. So this next chapter is number 40. So I think I just skipped one. And it's called All Around the World. Queen Elizabeth was our monarch. As far as we were led to believe, she was good at the job, and the rest of the world envied us for having her. So my school friend Adrian and I were disappointed to miss out on the peak of her silver jubilee, when the whole country paused for a week to celebrate her 25-year reign with a series of carefully orchestrated street parties. 35 years later, nothing changed, by the way. We were in France instead, among a handful of second years on the school's annual exchange trip to Nantes. The odd timing was drilled home as our coach made its way out to the M3 via Fulham, where countless brick walls had been painted with "God bless you, ma'am" messages of loyalty. Still, we promptly forgot about the Queen and everything else going on back in Britain the moment we boarded the ferry in Southampton. Spending two whole weeks in another country, living with another family, represented a new frontier, one that we hoped would be marked by successful encounters with alcohol and the opposite sex. Perhaps because we couldn't get our hands on it on the first of these items as easily as we hoped, we failed to get our hands on the second as well. There was a distinct language barrier with the French girls. And though there were actual females alongside us on the trip from the all-girls Charles Edward Brooks School just down the Camberwell New Road from Tennyson's, it turned out to be no easier to chat them up either. We just weren't used to being around girls. There was this one from CEB that I kept taking the mickey out of until we eventually decided to become friends and made plans to go out with each other when we got back to London. But almost as soon as we did so, I realised that being seen with her acne would make me a laughing stock. All in all, the trip looked like it was more fun for the older kids, mainly fourth years, as the third and fifth forms were busy with exams. Adrian and I made a promise to go again 2 years later, when we would have seniority and be free to run riot. Back in London, there was still Jubilee fever, so when the Queen's tour of the UK came to Kennington, we decided to stay after school to see her do her act. Adrian and I waited forever on Kennington Park Road, in our bright blue blazers, at the front of a crowd about 10 people deep, petrified to move from our spot for fear of missing her. Finally, at about 6 o'clock, we heard the cheers from further up the road. Along came the motorcade, police bikes, police cars, and then a very posh black car, a Daimler or a Bentley, with the Queen waving regally at us as she passed by. Being loyal subjects, we waved back. The motorcade continued on its way towards Camberwell, and that was that. The Queen's journey did not take her through Brixton, and for good reason. While riding the bus to school one day, we'd seen the graffiti that had gone up on the train bridge over Brixton Road. "Stuff the Jubilee" in big white painted letters. We could hear the old people on the bus gasp in shock. The next morning it had been painted over. Life was back to normal. Except that a couple of days after that, there it was again. "Stuff the Jubilee." At the same time, handbills started showing up around on the local walls, especially around Brixton Tube Station. They carried a picture up top of Queen Elizabeth, who earns £1 million a year, tax-free. Underneath was a picture of what looked like a dosser. "Elizabeth Queen, unemployed, earns £8 a week, including benefits." The posters had been printed by something called the Socialist Workers' Party, the SWP. There was another political party putting up posters around town with a statistic of their own. Something about how 90% of muggings were by black people and 90% of their victims were white. The flyers came with an instantly recognisable logo, NF, the two letters joined together as one. The National Front believed in Britain for the British, which meant repatriating all the blacks and the Asians and anyone else who wasn't white back to where they came from. My mother taught loads of West Indian and Asian children as she worked her way up through a number of tough South London schools and never spoke ill of them. My mate Chris Borough's mum worked on behalf of immigrant families at the Brixton Advice Centre, and his dad was a Labour councillor for Lambeth, and they too were supportive. And Adrian told me his parents were left of Labour. All of them made sure we understood that the National Front were, as Alex Harvey had put it when I'd seen him at Charlton, fascists. Still, there was a lot of NF graffiti around London. You had a sense that, like the Queen, they weren't going away anytime soon. Nor, it turned out, were the Sex Pistols. They re-emerged after several months' silence on Virgin Records, the label that had made its fortune on teenage prodigy Mike Oldfield and his Tubular Bells, with their own contribution to the Jubilee, a single called God Save the Queen. At first, people thought it was a cover version of the national anthem, like the group Queen had included on A Night at the Opera. But it wasn't. It was something else entirely. It was something that rhymed the title with fascist regime, that called the Queen a moron, a potential H-bomb. Radio stations wouldn't play it. Many record stores wouldn't stock it. Somehow, this didn't stop it rising up the charts until the very peak of her Silver Jubilee. God Save the Queen peaked at number 2 on the singles charts. Officially, at least, there were all kinds of rumours that it was basically number 1, but they wouldn't allow it. Once again, the Sex Pistols were all over the front pages. If they weren't being arrested for hosting their own anti-Jubilee party on the Thames, they were getting beaten up by right-minded monarchists. Johnny Rotten was attacked by 2 gangs in just 4 days, one of them wielding knives. Punk may have seemed like something of a sick joke 6 months earlier when the Pistols had sworn on TV and EMI had dropped the band under pressure, but now it looked like this was something serious. The Sex Pistols had lit a fuse. I didn't get to hear God Save the Queen any more than I'd heard Anarchy in the UK before it. None of my local 13-year-old friends had embraced it. And it was summer. There'd be no gathering on the football terraces for another month. The only way to hear God Save the Queen was to buy it. Except I didn't really buy singles anymore. I was a proper rock fan, wasn't I? I hadn't counted on my mother. Late in the summer holidays, reading about the Sex Pistols in the Times or the Guardian or whatever fold-out newspaper we had delivered, she asked if I had heard God Save the Queen and could tell her what all the fuss was about. And I said that I had not and therefore could not. And she said, well, next time you go to the record store, why don't you get a copy? I'll pay for it. I really wasn't sure I was going to like the Sex Pistols, but free music was free music. So I took the number 3 up to Crystal Palace, went into Counterpoint and asked a little sheepishly for a copy of God Save the Queen. They didn't have it. It wasn't that they refused to sell it, like some of the high street stores. It was that the single was more or less off the charts now, and they weren't ordering any more. They pointed me to the new Sex Pistols single, Pretty Vacant, instead. But I didn't want to get Pretty Vacant. It wasn't banned. It wasn't the same thing. I thought about going home and giving my mum back the money. But I figured she'd only say I should have bought something else, that I shouldn't have wasted the trip. I scanned the rest of the charts, looking for inspiration. Then I stopped. This was, what did the French call it? Deja vu? No, this was something more than that. I actually had been through this before. 5 years ago, I stood in this very record store in precisely the same position, with money in hand to buy a 7-inch and not a clue which record to get. Here I was, only 13 years old, and my life had already come full circle. So I decided to take the same course of action as back in 1972, to look through the picture sleeves, hoping that something would appeal to me, the way David Cassidy had appealed to my brother on my behalf. There were at least more picture sleeves to choose from now, and all of them, I quickly noticed, were for New Wave records. It seemed to go with the territory. The sleeves tended towards pictures of the group in menacing streetwear or menacing scenes of street chaos, or both. The band logos and song titles were all laid out in stencils or newspaper print or spray paint or just hand-drawn lettering. I didn't want to admit it, but the whole thing carried about it an air of excitement, the same way an imminent scrap did on the terraces. Finally, I found myself clutching a copy of All Around the World by The Jam, the punk group I really disliked. They were wearing black suits and white shirts, like they were office boys or something. Didn't they realise that kids of today hated the uniforms? Then again, their ties were loose at the collar like most of us wore them at Tennyson's, and they each had these distinctive black and white shoes that made them look different. And they were standing in front of a bright orange background with their logo spray-painted behind them, all 3 staring at the camera with an expression that seemed equal parts pride and contempt. I turned the single sleeve over. Now one of them was in a pink button-down shirt, just like the one I'd refused to wear as a hand-me-down for my brother. And he was holding over his right shoulder a black and white checkered jacket in exactly the same pattern that I'd also refused to wear on a duffel coat my mum had bought me as a little kid. How could they possibly think this stuff was fashionable? The camera had zoomed in on their faces here on the back, and it only made their expressions harder to read. The one in the middle, who I figured must be the singer, was wearing dark square shades. Because you couldn't see his eyes, his face was a totally blank canvas. They looked like yobs, like punks, but they were so well dressed that you could hardly place them in the same camp as the Sex Pistols. I couldn't make them out. And then, at the bottom of the back cover, there were three words, one under each band member: Direction, Reaction, Creation. This reminded me of The Who's second single, Anyway, Anyhow, Anywhere. And there was something else too, a credit for their hairdresser. No band, no rock star, no pop singer ever credited their hairdresser on the back of a single sleeve. Not unless they wanted people to think they were poofs. And I knew instinctively the Jam were not poofs. But there it was, hair, shoomy. And for a scruffy 13-year-old like me, whose straight blonde hair defied all attempts to shape it or style it, I had to admit, their haircuts were ace. They were short and they were sharp. I needed no more convincing. I bought the single sleeve. When I got it home, I figured I might as well play the record that came with it. All Around the World was just like I remembered the Jam from Your Mother Wouldn't Like It. A nasty assault of brittle voices and ugly guitars. The first word was oi, of all things, and it was shouted, not even sung. Besides, it was too short, barely 2 minutes. That was all right back in the 60s, I figured, but this was 1977. Times had changed. I turned the single over. Carnaby Street wasn't much better. The vocals were grunted, the harmonies shouted, and the guitar sounded like Pete Townshend playing badly. Really badly. It was a waste of money. My mum's money, admittedly, but I played All Around the World once more, and again it was finished before I knew it. So I played it once more. Every time it finished, I was still sure I hated it. Except that every time it finished, I felt compelled to play it again. And the more I played All Around the World, the more I grasped what had been missing from the rock music I'd been claiming for myself so earnestly this last couple of years. Not just power chords and feedback and gruffly shouted vocals, though that was a part of it, but black and white shoes, pink shirts, square glasses with black shades, haircuts that were neat but spiky, catchphrases like direction, reaction, creation, and above all, youth. The Jam may have been older than me, but they were so much younger than Pink Floyd and Bad Company and Nazareth and The Who that they could almost have been my big brothers. Best of all Around the World was singing about the new while saying we couldn't forget the old. That was something I really could identify with. Besides, the more I listened to it, the more that feedback guitar solo in the middle sounded like an update on the same section in Any Way, Anyhow, Anywhere. Finally, it dawned on me. This was a punk record made by mods. Teenage mods. Mods of the 1970s. Mods that I hadn't realised until now actually existed. Mods that I'd thought were confined to the booklet in Quadrophenia. My generation just might have its own Who, after all. Thank you. So, how are we doing for time? I figure, would you like to hear, I might as well ask you, because obviously this is all quite British, would you like to hear a chapter that's about John Peel? Do you know John Peel the DJ? Everybody know John Peel? Okay, or would you like to hear one that's sort of about the Gang of Four and the Four and Two Tone? Or do you want to hear both if we have time? Or should I shut up and we'll take the questions now? Anyone? Anybody got a preference?
Gang of Four.
Gang of Four? All right, let's move ahead to that one. And then I think what we'll do, because this next one might be just a little bit longer, and you can always take this moment if you need to order another drink or anything. I'm sure they won't mind serving you a drink. And then after that, I'm happy to take some questions about the book. And equally, of course, we do have copies for sale. This is how some of us try and earn our living, so don't let me discourage you from buying a copy. This is like much, much further on in the book. And by this point, I have started a fanzine. I called it In the City initially and then changed its name to Jamming when I found out there was another fanzine called In the City. I had written to a number of musicians after doing a few issues. And some of them have written back, including Paul Weller. And I got my first interview. And then gone and interviewed John Peel. And I'd interviewed Pete Townshend. I met Keith Moon right before he died. And all this stuff is in the book. But I'm jumping ahead here to, I guess, what's later in 1978. Music has changed a little bit. We've gone from that very direct punk that I was talking about to much more of a new wave. And my fanzine is up and running. And it's actually quite hip at this point. And there's also a bit of a mod revival going on, and a skinhead revival as well. And you heard me talk about the National Front early on, and that's going to come back. So this chapter is number 13, so you can tell I've jumped way ahead. It's called It's the New Thing. The Gang of Four were from Leeds. They were male, they were white, there were four of them, and they played rock music using guitar, bass and drums. And yet the way they approached that music was almost entirely different from anything coming out of London. The guitarist slashed at his instrument as if at random, inventing new chords as he went, while the drummer and bass player frequently hinted that they might be incorporating disco rhythms into the music. Verses would have some semblance of order until the choruses would erupt in a mass of repetitive, shouted vocals and the listener would be left clueless. The Gang of Four were unashamedly political. They were named after a breakaway faction of Chinese communists. They sang not about Saturday's Kids or the modern world like the Jam, but about capitalism and communism, and actually referenced the working classes in one song, as if speaking of a distinct species. Their first EP included the song titles Armour Like Rifles and Love Like Anthrax, words we barely understood. About the only band you could compare them with were the Mekons, who also hailed from Leeds and had a lyrically confrontational single of their own entitled Never Been in a Riot. And at least for their scratchy guitars, political lyrics and attendance at Leeds University, Scritti Politti. On the face of it then, the Gang of Four did not seem commercial. But things quickly happened for them. An acclaimed single on indie label Damaged Goods. A popular session for John Peel. Paul Weller, an early fan, invited them to open for the Jam at the Music Machine. And he urged me to get there in time to see them, which I did. And then, in the spring of 79, they signed to EMI. Immediately, there were letters in the NME noting that EMI was not just Britain's biggest record company, but also one of its biggest weapons manufacturers, and that a political band like the Gang of Four should think twice before signing with such a corporation. Of course, EMI is also the label that signed and promptly dropped the Sex Pistols. The Gang of Four, though, like Adam Ant before he left Decca with his tail between his legs, I just earlier interviewed Adam Ant, whose first single was a dismal flop, the Gang of Four, though, like Adam Ant before he left Decca with his tail between his legs, saw their deal, especially the size of their deal, as a victory for the oppressed masses over their corporate bosses. They even presented the precise terms of their lucrative contract to the British music press, right down to the complicated process of options, as if they were the first band from the north of England since punk to sign with a major record label. And actually, they probably were. But then they released their first EMI single, At Home He's a Tourist, and came up abruptly against reality. The original words to the song, as heard on their John Peel session, reference Durex in your top left pocket. By the time it came out on vinyl, this specific brand had been replaced by the word rubbers, apparently at EMI's insistence. This still did not satisfy the Top of the Pops producers, who, panicking at the potentially permissive effect of mentioning condoms to millions of pubescent wankers, insisted the Gang of Four change it again, this time to rubbish. The group, probably wondering if they might not be better off in totalitarian China after all, walked off the show rather than compromise further. They got tons of good press for doing so, but At Home He's a Tourist stalled at number 58, and the odds of them being invited back on Top of the Pops in the future were placed at zero. So much for changing the system from within. That was one of the problems with Top of the Pops. It played such an important part in the hit-making process, largely because there was almost no other opportunity to see a decent band on television, other than the old grey whistle test, which appeared stuck in the year 1975. But then something else came along. Broadcasting on BBC Two from a different city every Saturday night, something else claimed to be handing over the production reins to local youth. Didn't do anything of the sort, really. There was a reason the BBC was known as Auntie. But still, it made a welcome change to have some spotty teenager stumbling over his or her cues and Janet Street Porter or Whispering Bob Harris condescending to us. And something else did indeed have something else. Live bands. Good ones. Great ones. Including, on the same night in September 1979, The Jam and Joy Division. The Jam were the headline act, the ones with the hit singles and the long-standing reputation. And they played like it too, introducing the Eton Rifles to the public that night alongside a cracking version of When You're Young. And as much as anything, just looking like the best band in the world. Weller, with hair perfectly pointed at top, meticulously flattened otherwise, dressed all in sharp black apart from a two-tone guitar strap and conspicuous white socks. Bruce Foxton sported a fat silver tie knotted tight under a bright blue jacket, Buckler wore what looked like a cycling jersey, white with a single red and blue stripe. It was as far removed from Army parkas and Target t-shirts as could be, while remaining indisputably mod. It was also, come to think of it, very Southern. Joy Division, by comparison, though they also wore long-sleeved shirts, proper trousers and the occasional tie, dressed in muted colours, greys and off-whites, as if deliberately declaring their northern roots. Joy Division had not signed to EMI, or Polydor, or CBS, or even Rough Trade. They'd stuck with their Manchester home city's Factory Records, which had just released their debut album, Unknown Pleasures. John Peel had been playing Unknown Pleasures relentlessly this past couple of months, just like he had the couple of singles that preceded it, and an incredibly popular Joy Division session recorded at the start of the year. And if all this sounded similar to the Gang of Four, well, yes, Joy Division were male, they were white, there were four of them, and they played rock music using guitar, bass and drums. And yes, the way they approached their music was almost entirely alien to anything coming out of London or elsewhere. Joy Division's drums were compressed so tightly that they sounded almost electronic. Synthesizers were occasionally employed in a faintly sinister manner, and the lyrics were introspective to the point of depressing. And yet you had to be particularly cynical not to hear an incredibly powerful and novel emotion come charging through the middle of the music. There was something fresh about Joy Division, something that pointed to the future, something else. On the TV show that night, broadcast from Oxford Road in Manchester itself, Joy Division performed their new single, Transmission. The singer, Ian Curtis, began the song clutching the microphone so tightly you thought he'd never let it go. A mere half dozen teenagers, as if that was all the BBC could afford, stared at him from in front of the stage, bemused, motionless. Then the chorus kicked in. Dance, 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 dance to the radio. And there was a sudden twitch, a spastic gyration. The microphone appeared to leap out of its stand, and Curtis was running on the spot, his arms flailing, his voice rasping, his gaze at the camera so transfixing it was either the result of a serious speed habit or something much, much more intense. Later, on She's Lost Control, a song we already knew from Unknown Pleasures, Curtis went a step further, losing himself completely in that insane dance of his, like a man possessed by demons, gyrating for so long that we weren't sure he'd ever return to normality. His performance was all anyone could talk about at the Prince of Wales Conference Centre that evening. Located beneath the YMCA, close to the Centrepoint building, where Tottenham Court Road met Oxford Street, the Conference Centre had recently started hosting the cream of the flourishing independent label music scene. Those who had seen Joy Division appear there just the previous month luxuriated in their superiority as they sipped warm pints of lager at the bar. The rest of us took comfort in the fact that the band on top of the bill that night were also from Manchester, and that we might one day be able to claim that we'd seen them before they made it to national television. That band, The Fall, were equally popular with John Peel, who had already invited them in for a couple of sessions. They were also much liked by the music press, in part because frontman Marquis Smith gave good quotes. But unlike those other bands, there was nothing remotely anthemic about The Fall. The nearest Smith and his crew came to a pop song on their debut album, Live at the Witch Trials, was the one that went, "Yeah, yeah, Industrial Estate," as if sending up the whole concept of a chorus line. While their first single, It's the New Thing, had demonstrated a healthy cynicism about pop culture in general. Despite, or perhaps because of all this, Live at the Witch Trials was selling at a furious rate. Something about The Fall's straight-faced simplicity and Marquis Smith's earnest, half-sung, half-spoken Mancunian drawl had struck a nerve. Certainly, Live at the Witch Trials was refreshingly uncomplicated. All the instruments, including the cheap keyboard, seemed to play at once, and none of them appeared to have gone through a mixing board. The LP had actually been recorded one day and mixed the next. The Fall's dress code was equally unfussy. Cardigans, open collar shirts, V-neck sweaters. To cap it all, Marquis Smith spent most of his time on stage with his back to the crowd. In comparison, Skritti Politti, who were also on the bill at the YMCA, might as well have been The Clash. Live at the Witch Trials had been released by Step Forward, the same label that put out Alternative TV's records, which made it easy enough for jamming to land an interview with Marquis Smith. He was joined for it by his latest guitarist, Mark Riley. Smith was known as a difficult interviewee, but, and especially compared to Paul Weller once a microphone was thrust in his face, he proved perfectly talkative. Asked to define his ambitions for The Fall, he was clear-cut, to keep it going as long as I can, which I'm sure we'll all appreciate 40, 35 years on. Requested to explain his plain image, he was unapologetic yet polite. I'm just not into clothes, he shrugged. Invited to define his relationship to punk, he admitted the debt. Before the Pistols, I thought, if I get up on stage and start singing, people will just bottle me. Actually, they still did. At the Lyceum earlier in the year, the fall had opened for both Generation X and Stiff Little Fingers. Their bravery in the face of flying pint glasses had earned them begrudging respect, even from those who couldn't stomach their music. And asked outright whether a key line from Witch Trials, I still believe in the R&R dream, was sarcastic or serious, he admitted to me that it was half and half before opening up on the subject. My attitude is that we are rock and roll and no other fucker is, he said, lambasting those new wave bands that had re-embraced a dreaded sense of technique. Audiences don't know who's a good musician, but they know what's good. They feel it and they know it's good. It's like me. I can't sing, but I know what I'm doing is good. And I know that rock and roll is not the playing of instruments. You don't play instruments in rock and roll, and bands that do are copping out, in my estimation. As if to prove the point, I was given a test pressing of Dragnet, the band's second album. Produced by the enigmatically named Grant Showbiz, Dragnet was so thin you could barely hear it. I subsequently wrote in Jamming that it sounds like it's been recorded in a bathroom. I had assumed that this was the Fall's intent, but after the piece was published, Smith wrote in to say that while we're into bad tribal sounds, most of Side 2 sounds better without the original window polish ridden pressing. His was a common complaint amongst the new independent label groups, who approached their craft rudimentarily perhaps, but with pride nonetheless, and were furious when mastering studios and pressing plants alike wouldn't afford them the courtesy of a professional service. As he had with Alternative TV, Step Forward's Nick Jones was good enough to take out an ad for the new Fall album in Jamming. Paul Weller was kind enough to do the same thing for his new publishing company, Riot Stories, which was putting out a book of poetry by his old Woking schoolmate, Dave Waller. I ran the Waller and Fall full-page ads opposite each other, not to dismiss them as such, but because they both featured poems, lyrics. It was like an extra editorial section. I thought the ads complemented each other for other reasons, too. The Fall and the Jam each exuded self-belief, self-righteousness, perhaps, that could be difficult to digest but was impossible not to respect. Though the Jam had some of Smith's derided technique, recorded for a major label, had spent 3 months on their new album rather than the 3 days that the Fall took for Dragnet, and with the very height of fashion, each band had an unequivocal, highly visible leader, someone who took his work seriously, who believed in his band, who spoke his mind clearly and took shit from no one. You could like both bands without appearing not to have made up your mind. More so than you could at this point claim to love both The Jam and The Clash, at least in front of Paul Weller. Around election time, The Clash had released the Cost of Loving EP. No, they hadn't. Start again. Around election time, The Clash had released their Cost of Living EP, and Weller had openly scoffed at their cover of I Fought the Law. He felt they had disappeared up their own arses in self-mythology. Plus, The Clash were obsessed with the USA, and Paul despised the place. He was obsessed with Britain instead. So perhaps that's why, in the letter he wrote to me after publication, Marquis Smith not only paid the surprising compliment that your attitude is fucking great and I wish it was more prevalent, but that you've also made me seriously rethink my attitude to mod and a few other things. At the same time, they shared a Jamming front cover with 4 other groups. The Jam and the Fall all shared the top of our readers' charts, along with the Specials, Madness, the Chords, Secret Affair, the Purple Hearts, Stiff Little Fingers, and in case this all points to the Fall as the odd one out, the Raincoats, Swell Maps, and an anarchist punk band called Crass, who were selling copies of their controversial 17-track EP, The Feeding of the 5,000, faster than Small Wonder Records could press them. All in all, this 9th issue of Jamming was the epitome of eclecticism. At a time when everyone was taking sides on the style divide, Jamming embraced, seemingly, everything. Joining The Jam and The Fall was my mate Jeff's long-standing idol, Shrink, along with his latest idols, The Pack, fronted by a handsome blonde punk with a megaphone for a voice, Kirk Brandon. Their single, King of Kings, was on Rough Trade. And I was excited to feature the band Rudy from Belfast, who had been the first ever act on the Good Vibrations label, the same label that had given us the Undertones and Teenage Kicks, and who, with their long overdue follow-up, I Spy, had now released what I thought was the best power pop single of the year. Plus, we finally got over the stigma of only featuring white acts. I'd been hoping to get to Two Tone Specials or Madness, given their popularity with the nation in general and the younger end of our readership in particular. But my printer, Jolly, told me I should bypass both bands for the label's newest signing, the Selector. With his help, I went to the Electric Ballroom, a few steps from Camden Town Tube Station, and interviewed them before their first big London headlining show. All I knew about the Selector was that a song of that name had appeared on the B-side to the Specials' Gangsters, that their first proper single on two-tone, The Irrepressible on My Radio, backed by the irresistible Too Much Pressure, had just that week entered the top 40, and that, like the Specials, they hailed from Coventry. As it turned out, there wasn't much more to know, except that you couldn't sit still to them if your life depended on it. Nobody sat still that night at the Electric Ballroom, especially not the Skinheads. They danced their way enthusiastically through the opening band, a multiracial act from Birmingham called The Beat. They put up with the middle act, an all-girl group called the Modettes, who made up in charm for what they lacked in polish. And they went ballistic to the Selector. Throughout the headlining band's hour-long set, the core of the crowd was a sea of bobbing bald heads, all doing the Skinhead Moonstop stomp, and Zeke Heiling while they were at it. This, then, was where we'd found ourselves. At the end of a decade marked by muggings and packy bashings alike, a decade notable for the rise of the National Front, for the eventual fight back on the streets of Lewisham, for Rock Against Racism and the Anti-Nazi League and their successful festivals in Hackney and Herne Hill, for the election of Maggie Thatcher on an anti-immigrant platform, and the unfortunate rise and now hopefully the overdue fall of Sham 69, we finally had a musical movement whose very name, Two Tone, proclaimed a desire to bring black and white kids together. A movement that celebrated Jamaican ska music and English fashion alike. A movement that didn't care about the colour of your skin as long as you didn't care either. And yet, as the six black and one white member of the Selector flew the two-tone flag at a ballroom in Camden Town, a floor full of Skinheads dancing in front of them offered the Nazi salute as a sign of appreciation. The Selector had a song called They Make Me Mad. It probably hadn't been written about the Skinheads, but as the band played it that night, it must surely have crossed their minds. Thank you very much. Amy, could I trouble you for a glass of the wonderful Outrage?
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Sure. We've got Tony's book here for sale.
Yeah. We absolutely, we do, and for signing, and you know, and please, you know, come forward and order a drink, whatever. I'm always happy to take a bit of Q&A. Don't be shy. I know there's only a few of us here, but if anybody wants to ask anything about this book or the scene that I was around, or you know, anything related to the other books, now's your chance.
What was Pretty Political like?
In concert, in person, in interview.
Both.
I actually read. Thank you very much, Amy. I actually read from this when I just did a little reading in New York City. When we first went to see them, they were doing their first gig. They'd been kind of like backed into it, and we interviewed them without seeing them. We kind of like running a fanzine, and we just went to this gig and walked backstage and like, which group are you? Skriddy Blit, can we interview you? And they'd never been interviewed before either, basically. And they were making up songs on the spot, and that for me was just like revolutionary. So they actually come at that point in between writing about, you know, my very sort of straight rock taste, which is fair enough, I was 13, 14, and being into the Jam and the Buzzcocks and all this, and then being exposed to Skriddy Blit. I used to go up and hang out at their squat where they all lived in Camden Town, and it was, there's a photo of it on one of their record sleeves. It was like, if you took this shelf of books and sort of turned it upside down on the bar and put like a couple of amplifiers at the foot of it and then put all the dirt, all the washing up for the entire week in the sink, and then smoked a dozen joints and let the smell hang around the room, that was their squat. And it was like this really intense place where everybody argued, you know, communism and Marxism, and listened to Jamaican 7-inch, you know, dub imports. It was, yeah, and then the band would practice. It was a great place.
You hear all that in the music.
Yeah, it was exciting. And live, you know, live they were really, really interesting, because it was, I was saying about the Gang of Four, but there was more reggae to Skriddy Politi. And it was this moment when bands started like making up chords. Like they just put their fingers on the guitars and play these random sounds. And the whole music got freed up. And it was this amazing time. And they were very, very, very important to all of that. You were going to ask them?
You mentioned something about Adam and the Ants. Mm. I was just curious if you could tell the shame of Adam and the Ants. You said something about how he disappeared and changed.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole... One thing I tried to do with this book was ensure that the characters didn't just come and go. And that includes the musicians, and includes my school friends, all the people that I write about in there. And when my fanzine stepped up a level from being like a school fanzine printed on a school machine to being properly printed, we got an interview with Paul Weller, an interview with John Peel, and an interview with Adam Ant. And at that point, Adam and the Ants were this like outrageous punk band that people thought were into bondage and Nazis. And you know, he was really part of that like original Sex Pistols crowd, this sort of leather and bondage decadent sex crowd. And but he had signed to Decca Records, which was the most uncool label on the planet, even though they did put out all the early Who singles. They were so uncool. And I went to interview him, and he was like this, you know, like, the kids are the greatest thing, you're my bed and butter, will never let you down, and all this stuff about punk. And their first single was this song called Young Parisians, which you actually cannot find. It's like about the only chapter title in this book I can't find digitally. And it was like, it had an accordion, it was like so commercial, and it just flopped dismally. And Decca dropped Adam and the Ants immediately. And it was, I think it was Adam Ant's first sort of like being ready to sell out for success. And it didn't work. And then what happened really weirdly, and it is a theme in the book, is that around 1980, as the book comes to its kind of climax, he releases the album Dirt Wears White Socks, I think it was. And that really takes off as his big indie album. So then he becomes even more punk. And then actually when he, after the book, but not long after the book finishes, when he actually then signs to CBS and does the whole pirate thing, it just looks like the biggest sellout of all time. So I wanted to kind of have Adam Ant as this sort of thread of somebody who maybe is really looking to be famous at all costs, but he's happy to have this credibility that'll help him. So that's the reference. You know, there's an earlier reference about interviewing him. He was very, very, very nice when I interviewed him, I must say, and I was kind of like nervous because I thought he was this decadent, you know, bondage wearing Nazi supporting punk rocker, and he was actually this quite intellectual guy with, you know, glasses like I now wear.
To that point, who was the most colourful or challenging interview that you had?
The most colourful or challenging?
Yeah.
During that period, the very first interview I did was in many ways the most challenging. It was with Paul Weller, and yeah, I read from that section a couple of times. He was always a difficult interview, and I think for a lot of people still is. He was very, very nervous. Like, I was very, very nervous, but he was nervous. And yeah, I got invited up to the studio where they were finishing off all Mod Cons, and I was like, as you can tell, massively into the Jam. And I'm like sitting in the studio with my big tape recorder sat on a Vox amp, and like sitting right next to him. And I would ask him a question, and he sort of like fumbled his way through the answer and pause and stop, and then I'd be like, okay, I guess that's the answer, and I'd go to talk, and then he'd suddenly start talking again. And I kind of realised after a while that's how he was, that you had to kind of like step back and let him find his thoughts. Colourful, the most colourful back in that period. Easy. There's a fantastic chapter towards the end of it. Oh, the funniest interview I ever did in my life was with the Damned. With no shadow of a doubt, we caught them at this great moment, and they were recording in this run-down little studio next to where my mum taught, opposite the Crystal Palace football ground. And they were a reasonably big band, and the Jam were recording at the same time in this massively posh studio in central London. And we went down there, three or four of us. One of my mates was a skinhead who considered himself an anarchist because he was trying to move away from being called a racist. And the Damned thought that was absolutely hilarious and went through this whole thing of deciding they should jump on him and stomp on him and see how anarchist he was then. And they were like, throw him outside! Let's see how anarchist he is when you throw him outside. And Captain Sensible was, I mean, I could read from some of it. He was talking about what he'd like to do to the Queen, which is, you know, the Queen's another, you know, theme, and what he'd like to do to the Clash. And how, you know, the Clash are basically boring heavy metal, same as the old stuff. Next! And I, you know, mentioned the Jam. And he's like, the Jam? Their drummer told me he wanted to dye his hair blonde, but his mum wouldn't let him. Don't you think they're a bunch of suburban, boring wankers? And the whole interview was like that. And they actually, Dave Vanian kind of almost destroyed my tape recorder. About 3 hours later, we left. And I ended up kind of laughing at it when I printed the interview absolutely verbatim. And I kind of got to know the captain a little bit better after that. And he loved it. He always thought it was like the funniest interview that they'd ever done. Definitely the Damned. Anyone else for anything else? Come on, somebody got a question?
I think it's interesting, like you mentioned you had friends, but it just seems like in England, guys,
yeah,
more maybe than girls, would go alone to concerts. And mm-hmm. I find that really different from America. And, you know, maybe part of the reason why punk was such a, you know, just spread much more than here, was more concentrated in cities,
yeah.
I think. So, like, why did you go out alone? Like, was that just what people...
Yeah, very, very, very good question, because it gets us a couple of themes in the book. One is that, as you can probably tell, my mum plays quite a central role in the book. When the book opens, my dad had just left home, and so my mum's actually treating me and my brother to a single. It's almost like this is sort of the start of our new life. And part of my mum being a single-parent family is my mum's a teacher. At some one point, she had to work evenings as well, and we were what you call latchkey kids. So we basically had a key to the house and we came and went. And a lot of us were doing that in London at the time. Now, you know, you look back further, if you read Morrissey's autobiography, and I've also been reading Graham Nash's, they're both set in Manchester, and they're just... Well, they're about growing up in a Manchester where, you know, I mean, you just, like, went off for the day, you'd play on bomb sites, you know, your parents never even really thought where you were until they, you know, it's too late and they called the police. And there were a couple of times I came back home at the age of 14, 15 and my mum was on the phone to the police, you know, because the phone boxes never worked. Basically, people used them as toilets and then smashed them up, and I never seemed to carry money anyway. So a lot of us were kind of running a little bit wild, and I am still really good friends with most of the characters that are in this book, and we've met back up, and most of us are parents now, and we're like, we would not let our kids do that.
But you said you went to Pink Floyd by yourself.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Without some friends, yeah. Like people just went.
Yeah, but I think that, sorry, and I got maybe a slightly off with that, but I think that part of that was just that you would kind of just wander off. You kind of go to things on your own. And I think I did it more than other people. I think I had a certain kind of curiosity. But I know that I had other friends who would go to gigs on their own, because it did seem that you could do it. And it would have been nicer to have, like, maybe had a girlfriend and be snogging away in somebody's room, but that didn't seem to be happening, so we kind of went off to gigs. And, I'm just getting to the point that I think it's unusual, because I would think twice about letting my kid go off to a gig on their own at the age of 14, let alone at the age of 13 to see Pink Floyd.
Except that you were right in London.
Well, we were, but, I mean, you know, We lived in New York, and I don't know how comfortable I'd have been with Campbell going to gigs. It just feels like we just had this freedom, and a lot of us just went off and did things on our own. And I think it was true maybe to the time more than anything else. And maybe, you know, those of us who are a little bit lost, I don't have no qualms admitting this at all. You know, I'm lacking a father figure at home. I mean, that's blatantly evident in the book. And in some ways, I'm off sort of searching for that. So I'm off kind of like going to see these bands, going to look for these role models in these rock stars, because I want that kind of figure in my life. So I think my situation was a little bit like, well, mum's not home, mum's working, don't get on with my brother too well. I may as well just go off to gigs because I'm happy here. This is my world. And I was this very, you know, part of the interesting thing about this book is at the age of 14, 15, you know, my voice hadn't broken. You know, I hadn't hit puberty. I was getting beaten up at school because I was this, you know, little roundish kid with weird haircut who, you know, wasn't an adolescent yet. And but if I went to gigs, I was okay. I was respected. It was like, wow, this kid's gone.
Can you describe yourself to me? That sounds like pretty much any rocker.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of it. I think that, you know, that you've got your school bullies who are really happy just being tough at school, and then maybe you've got your sports people, and then you've got, you know, those of us who aren't fitting in. And for those of us who didn't fit in, punk did actually offer a way to fit in.
It
even
was very
though
different than over here. It was like, you know, the ritual of, like, you know, you may have like two or three other friends in school and
yeah.
together tightly and
yeah.
go to concerts together and everything.
We
and
did
the suburbs.
Yeah, we did end up going to concerts together. There's stuff in the book where as I get a bit older, I get more of like a little unit of friends going and we go together. But I think my situation was unusual. I think this sort of latchkey kid thing was kind of prevalent, but mine was extra unusual because there was only one parent at home to begin with. Yeah. Anything else, or should we put the music back on? And, you know, anybody wants to get a book, I'll hang out and sign it. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate everybody bearing with me. Thank you. Thanks very, very, very much. Thank you.